Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, his two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and descended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Wednesday, March 18th, we are studying Genesis chapter 31, verses 1 to 24. In today's text, the growing tension between the households of Jacob and Laban leads Jacob to flee from Laban without telling him ahead of time. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have this regular guest, Pastor Sam Belts. Pastor serves at St. John Lutheran Church in Oskaloosa, Iowa. Pastor Belts, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Thanks so much for having me, Tim. Looking forward to it.
And talk to us about the context of Genesis 31 as we get started today.
This, the dramatic episode of Jacob as he, you've been studying this, as he enters into Laban's household, as he works for Laban, as he marries Leah and Rachel, as he has his children, all of this after, of course, stealing the blessing from Esau. Jacob is a rather dramatic and divisive figure across many circles about, you know, how is it that God chooses him? Why is it that God sets his favor upon him? If God knows he's going to be a trickster, if God knows he's going to be manipulative and all these sorts of things. And that's a great question to ask. And it just reveals that we're not God, that we're not the ones that pick and choose, that God's the one that picks and chooses. And sometimes his agents on earth are devout and holy and pious in every aspect of their daily lives. You know, much like one of Jacob and Israel's later sons, Joseph, pious and devout and morally a tremendous amount of fortitude. And then you have all the rest of his other sons that seem to fit in with Jacob, you know, and later Israel's personality, you know, angry, not getting what they want, almost echoing Laban's children here, you know, which is an interesting piece of connection that we can make when we get into the story. Anyway, so the whole context here, if somebody hasn't recently read through the Jacob narratives or the narratives of even Isaac and Jacob in the later episodes of the Genesis account leading up into the captivity of Egypt, it is a dramatic and action-packed in a lot of ways episode. I always wish that Missouri Synod Lutherans would put together good graphic novels of these stories. I see graphic novels every once in a while that take up the stories of the judges or something like that, which is really great. But we need to do this is a call to CPH to get some artists on board to do graphic novels of these episodes, like of Jacob and Laban and Jacob and Esau and, you know, all these events of the Old Testament that are really dramatic and have a lot of imagery that we could draw on, you know, and storylines that are important for us to remember. But today we take up the story of Jacob from fleeing from Laban, which again is dotted and connected to all these other episodes that have come before it that are all matrixed, of course, together, that hold together in this system of God's providence and care. He is the one who is going to have his way in the human creation to bring about salvation through this particular people that have started with Abraham. And there's nothing that's going to stop him, not even the unrighteousness and paganism of Laban, or the trickiness and seeming immorality. Well, it's not seeming immorality. It is the immorality of Jacob. That is not even going to stop. That's not going to stop God from having his way in these episodes, which is a really excellent reminder for us, especially in the season of Lent, I think, that despite our sin, despite our corruption, despite the fact that we still struggle, despite our immorality at times, nevertheless, God will finally have his way. His will finally prevails over all things, even sin and death. And there's nothing we can do to stop that. We really cannot do anything to stop this. God is going to have his way one way or the other.
Good. All right. So just from the last text, Jacob's flocks have multiplied miraculously, as we will hear again in the text today. That's causing the tension between the two households. And Jacob realizes it at the beginning of this text. So this is Genesis 31, beginning at the first verse. Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, "Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has gained all this wealth." And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. I'm going to pause there at verse 3, this opening scene, which does very much connect to the previous text, but adds this word that the Lord speaks to Jacob as a pretty key part as to why things go the way they do. So talk about the tension that's building between the families and how Jacob realizes it, and then God speaks.
Yeah, so I think I never know where to start with this. I'm going to start with the word of God. So this Sounds is good. Not a dream. This is not some, you know, meditative hypnosis or anything like this. This is a clear, direct communication from God to Jacob in relation to what his future course is supposed to be. You know, whereas the call of God in our day, as the writer of the Hebrews lets us know, is mediated through the text of the scriptures and for the purposes of our tradition, through the church. That is the official direct call that God uses to assign men or, you know, people to certain offices and vocations across time. Here you have this direct word of God that comes to Jacob, and it now reveals what his future course is going to look like. Returning to the land of your fathers, okay, so that is Isaac and Abraham, and to your brother, right, to Esau, which will, of course, cause tension and anxiety moving forward. This, of course, turns into a whole other episode of Jacob's return with his family, with his children, with his wives, with his flocks back to Esau. You're going to cover that with somebody else probably, which develops a whole other episode here. You have the wrestling with God and all these other instances where the trajectory of Jacob's life changes, but this comes directly from God. And it culminates with a promise. This is a promise that is significant for Jacob. I will be with you. This is a tremendous promise. This promise overshadows, it determines and overshadows all other aspects of what will follow and what has preceded this narrative. As if it hasn't been clear enough already, this is a direct promise that God gives to Jacob about what will happen over the course of the next years of your life. I will be with you. This is a reiterated promise that God has given to Abraham and Isaac before. This is a promise that doesn't come to Esau. This is a promise that doesn't come to any other person that we know of that is recorded, at least in the text of Scripture. This is directly for Jacob. This promise, of course, this is important for us in the season of Lent. In the season of Lent, I normally work through the Psalms, but you could just as easily work through this. The chaos, the randomness, the chaos, and the immorality that has taken place over the course of the last several chapters would have us doubting that God is present in and amongst what is taking place on earth. Why would God be mixed up with this? This is a major question that a lot of people struggle with. I am surrounded by Reformed people. If a Reformed theologian were to look at these passages, one of their first conclusions would be God is not present here. The devil is winning. Mm-hmm. And all these sorts of things, which is probably an accurate thing to say to a certain extent until this word of God comes, until this gets said. And again, this is not Jacob's musing. This is not Laban's, you know, contribution. This isn't even Leah or Rachel. This is God, like God cracking open the heavens at the transfiguration, which we have all just heard, saying, this is my son. I love him. Listen to him. This is just as direct and sure a statement from God to Jacob as that moment was for Jesus and for those who were with him. I will be with you is a statement that I always focus on the season of Lent in Psalm 23. The promise that God makes in Psalm 23 isn't that we will skirt around the valley of the shadow of death, or that we'll get under it, or that God will transport us over it, or anything like that. The promise of Psalm 23 is that you're going to go through this. I am walking through the valley of the shadow of death, and you are with me. That is the promise. The great promise is that when we go this path through this valley of the shadow of death, when everything seems to be covered by the shadow of death, and corrupt and bankrupt of the presence of God, the promise of God, his word, is more sure than what we are seeing going on around us. And that is what God is desiring for Jacob here, is that, like, God's hand has been with Jacob. He's been putting sticks in a trough, and the sheep have been multiplying. Like, what are we talking about here? This God is obviously favoring Jacob throughout his life, leading to this prosperity, which is like, who puts sticks? What is the, what? I don't know the Arabic farming strategy that goes along with this. What sort of trees, like, what are we really talking about? And where can we get a hold of this? Because beef prices are ridiculous right now, and we need more beef cows. Like, let's get some of these sticks over in the United States and figure this out. But whatever, like, God's presence and God's hand are here. His providence and care, his overreaching will determining the course of life for Jacob and all of creation, as it turns out. And the promise that shines forth in all this is, I will be with you. That is a tremendous promise. We should not overlook this. Now,
I just real quick, Pastor, that echoes what the Lord had said to Jacob at Bethel when he was on his way here. And so to hear it repeated, absolutely, we have to pay attention to that. The call to come back.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so like you were saying, all these things are interwoven. That's the connection to Bethel. So there we get the Lord's word to Jacob. Any thoughts about the situation, the rising tension between the two households?
Yeah, so this of course this completely makes sense. The real world, like, sort of on the ground, this is not exceptional. This is boring and predictable. This is exactly the way any sinners would work if some new son-in-law marries into the family and has tremendous success in the father's business or whatever. And the sons, the natural born sons, can't get it together. I think I have heard about this actually happening. Somebody coming in from the outside, entering into a family business, that person from the outside has insights and success and management skills or whatever. They're able to see things and delineate things. The success of the business increases, and the business owner, because he's a savvy business owner, starts leaning towards this outsider who has now come in to have success and to fortify the family business and to fortify the family earnings, where the natural born sons are sort of, you know, just not as good at it, right? That seems to make complete sense to me. I think I've heard that story. I've seen movies made of this story. I've read books about this story. This is a completely relatable, boring, and predictable story. And so is the reaction of the sons of Laban. They see this outsider come in. They're mad. They, like, by, you know, they think it's by whatever, you know, this manipulations and thievery, which would make sense given Jacob's history, that he has come to the success of these flocks. As it turns out, it's by this ridiculous stick method of, you know, breeding sticks and drinking stick water or whatever's going on, you know, eating stick food. This whole thing that's going on beforehand and God's hand to multiply these flocks and, you know, all this sort of stuff and the agreement and the negotiation that takes place between Laban and Jacob, you know, yeah, I see it as being completely normal and relatable. Also, tragically, right, as that is relatable, so is the favor of Laban, right? So we don't, of course, have the complete story as to exactly what all the mechanism was for Laban's decrease of favor towards Jacob. But I could totally see this being that the sons, Laban's sons, are gnawing at their father's ear about how terrible Jacob is. He's bad. He's trying to steal all your income and wealth. Like, I could totally see that happening. It makes complete sense that something like that would happen. And so as the sons get increasingly disinterested and disfavorable towards Jacob, so does Laban get increasingly disinterested and disfavorable towards Laban or towards Jacob. And Jacob notices this. He is not imperceptive. That's one of the things about Jacob is that he is very perceptive about circumstance. He's very perceptive about what will probably be the trajectory of his course of life with regards to this earthly plane. You know, he sees the way that things interact. He sees the way things are happening. He's already been able to read Laban like a book in previous episodes and manage and manipulate and sort of dance around the things that have happened. And so here we also have this, you know, this, I hesitate to call it wisdom, but this common sense about the way you know, I think Jesus encourages, or I don't think, I know that Jesus encourages his disciples in the episodes when he's teaching and training them to be as meek as doves and as shrewd as serpents when he's interacting with the sons of this world. And Jacob seems to be an Old Testament embodiment of that particular point of catechesis, that when we are interacting with these, the pagan world, when we're interacting with the structures of the world that are in the end, as St. Paul teaches us and as Jesus teaches us, finally employed and empowered by the prince of the air and the demonic things, we don't struggle against flesh and blood. We struggle against these forces of evil. When you have to navigate those realities, right, in civil governments and in, you know, interactions with neighbors and all these sorts of things, people that are outside of the boundaries of Christianity, you have to be shrewd. You have to be meek and you have to be shrewd. And Jacob, I think one of the things that's disturbing of a lot towards a lot of people is that he's very shrewd. He is a shrewd businessman. He is a shrewd dealer with the world. And that, you know, that comes off to a lot of, you know, sort of well put together, buttoned up, moral Midwesterners in particular. He's kind of a dirty, nasty figure. But that's it, right? He's navigating a nasty, hostile family, gritty, nasty situation. He's already kind of been duped into marrying two women, which wasn't his original plan. It was Laban's plan. He's navigated that successfully. It turns out he's been successful in, he's having children. Now he's having flocks. This is like Laban thought he was going to get Jacob, you know, really stick him. Hasn't happened. Like maybe some of Laban's anger has translated over to the kids. Like Laban was maybe, you know, got Twitter painted to a certain extent with Jacob because of all of his success and everything that he brought to the table. Now the sons are sort of doubling down on their disfavor, and Laban is getting, you know, turning around on this. And this word comes from God. It's like, all right, you know, time. I have my, what I brought you here for, the word that I gave you at Bethel, as you mentioned, has now run its course. And now it's time to move. Now it's time to go. You know, this, I think this is a fair consideration. You know, if we wanted to go beyond this, talking about the call, you could talk about it officially as sort of the deliberations that pastors go through is my time here over? Has something very clear happened that reveals this to me in time, or, you know, perhaps through prayer and meditation and discernment from God, or, you know, at any time, right? Has my time, like, this is sort of the more general vocational call that God gives to all human beings, whether it's in a particular position as a worker or whatever, you know, has my time here ended? Has this situation run its course and now it is time to go? There are signs that God gives to us, I think, across time and in daily life that perhaps lead us towards these sorts of decisions and lead us to move, you know, and that's where we're at with Jacob. His is a little bit more divine. He has a direct revelation. We don't all get that. You know, generally that is not something that happens, but now he has it and he's going to be, you know, making his preparations for departure.
Yes. The only difference between well, I shouldn't say the only, but a big difference between the journey to Laban's household and now the journey away from Laban's household is that Jacob has a household of his own. He made this trip all by himself previously. Yep. Now he's going to take his entire household along with him, which is pretty significant at this point.
Yes.
And he needs his wives to come with him. Yep. So that's where the text takes us next, is the conversation Jacob has with Rachel and Leah. We pick up the text again at verse 4 of Genesis 31. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was, and said to them, "I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, 'The spotted shall be your wages,' then all the flock bore spotted, and if he said, 'The striped shall be your wages,' then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream that the goats that mated with the flock were striped, spotted, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Lift up your eyes and see, all the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred.' Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? for he has sold us, and he has indeed devoured our money. All the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do. And that's verse 16. We'll pause there again. So you mentioned the shrewdness of Jacob. And in verse 4, it's a small thing perhaps, but I think you see his shrewdness, that he calls Rachel and Leah, and they actually go to have this conversation out in the field where the flock was. It seems away from anybody. You know, like that's not where you would expect to have a conversation with your family like this, but I think that's part of Jacob's shrewdness.
Yep, no, it is. I mean, you would expect this out of like a out of some gritty mobster movie, like out in a cornfield in New Jersey or something like that, right? Like, let's get out of town. Let's get away from all the wires and the brothers and the servants and, you know, who knows who could be hiding in the flocks and all that sort of stuff. Let's get out here into the middle of nowhere and let's have our conversation, you know? And, you know, that's the way I act in my household with my six kids. Like, I have to go on into my room and then into my inner closet with my wife to have any sort of private conversation when we want to talk about anything. Right. And even then the kids are like down in their room listening through the vent to try to hear what exactly we're talking about, because they're always convinced that it's about their birthday or presents or something that they're going to get or whatever. Right. And we're just trying to, like, you know, take a breath and talk about what we're going to have for dinner. So Jacob and his wives go out into the middle of the field with all the flocks, and they have this again. This is a tragic but very relatable episode where these two girls are reflecting back on the work of their father. Now, this is a tragic moment where these two girls reveal, or they've perhaps had this revelation across time because of what has happened earlier. Their father has sold them. Like, their father has had almost little care for these two daughters. It was like he was trying to trick Jacob. Jacob ends up loving these two women, having children with them. God is merciful to these two women. And now they're revealing that their father has, like, it's not just that their father has lost favor for Jacob. Their father has lost favor for them, his daughters. And their father has consumed the whatever inheritance might be coming to them, the money or inheritance that might be theirs to take with them to make their family, that's all been eaten up by Laban's household. So this is this tragic, death that is taking place. These girls are, you know, to a certain extent mourning the loss of what should be in many minds, one of the most secure relations between a father and his daughter. And many, I hope that my relation with my daughters is always good. I hope to never turn a back on my children. I pray that we can always be relational and friendly throughout all of our days. That is my prayer for me and my children. One of my prayers for me and my children, that we can grow to be friends, that we can grow to have a good relationship, that we can increase in our love for one another and not our disfavor. But here, you have this tragic story of a father who has increasingly disfavorable towards his two daughters who have married Jacob. And it's probably because they've married Jacob and of Jacob's success that his favor for them has decreased, because they're both happy with Jacob, right? They have received children from Jacob and from God, right? From Jacob's God. The God of Laban, the gods of Laban have not been favorable to Laban. The gods of Laban have not been favorable to Laban's daughters. You see this now, like you've seen it in the past between the Philistines and Israel, or as you will see between the Philistines and Israel, and in other aspects between Abram and Isaac. Like, when God sets his favor on you, when he has determined that you are his, there is nothing that can thwart him. What thwarts is us, right? What thwarts is our perception, our faith or lack thereof, our insights into God and what he is up to. When we fall on the fact that he is disfavorable to us, when we fall on the fact that he cannot be trusted, when we fall on the fact that he's holding out on us, then we succumb to that. And that's never true. That's the thing. That's never true. God is steadfast and loving and kind, and he always wants what's good, not only for his creation, but also for his people. It's when we become convinced that he doesn't want that things always fall apart. And thankfully, Jacob doesn't believe that. He has these constant reminders from God, as we hear here from Bethel, as we have heard from Isaac, as we have seen from Abraham, God's favor is with Jacob. And I think, too, also going back to this, this is precisely why these two women break in here, and they say at the end, now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. That is an amazing statement. That, and it's, it is, I don't think it's inconsequential that the previous episode ends with, I will be with you. And now this episode ends with a similar sort of direction command from the women. Do it. Yeah. We have messed around here long enough. We've seen what's happening in our father's household. We see that our brothers hate you. We see that this is going bad. We trust whatever your God has said to you. We no longer trust the pagan gods of Laban. We no longer see any. They do not favor us. They do not favor him. If we have no hope with them, whatever God, whatever your God, whatever our God has said, do it. Yeah. That is an amazing statement.
Absolutely.
This is a tremendously faithful statement from these two women. They trust the God of Israel.
Let's pick this up on the other side of the break, because I think this is a really good point, and yes, I don't want to interrupt you in the middle of it. Right. So let's pick that thought up on the other side. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Sam Belts this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Who does Lutheran Church Extension Fund serve, you ask? It's simple. We serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers with loans and ministry services. And it's faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, investing with LCEF that makes it possible for LCEF to serve these ministries. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Wednesday, March 18th. We're studying Genesis chapter 31, verses 1 to 24 with Pastor Sam Belts. He serves at St. John Lutheran Church in Oskaloosa, Iowa. Pastor Belts, prior to the break, we were talking about the faithfulness of Rachel and Leah at the end of verse 16, where they tell Jacob, "Now then, whatever God has said to you, do." And I know you've got a lot to say on that, but before you do, it stands out to me, thinking through Genesis, you know, when Eve gave Adam the fruit, yep, and when Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham, and this is, you know, I mean, obviously temptation comes from all over the place. It's not just the wives that are tempting their husbands, but it does strike me that from this family, with all of the dysfunction that you've seen in the previous chapter when it came to their kids, that suddenly you have these two wives who are being very faithful, yep, and directing Jacob not to listen to what they think, but to listen to what God has said is a marvelous picture of a again, I know Jacob's family's got its problems, to be sure, but to see the faithfulness at this moment is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and so this, I think this point that you're bringing up is a important point for all Christians to reflect upon. It is an important point for all Christians to reflect upon because we like to believe that heritage or family are the sole determiner of future trajectories. This is not the case. This is absolutely not the case. Whenever God sets his, whenever he fixes on a person or a people, whenever his will captures and on somebody, he determines everything. There was nothing socially or religiously or anything that would have led Rachel and Leah to be in the position that they are in, other than apart from the will of God. God directed Jacob to go to this place. Everything was directed towards the marriage of Leah and Rachel. In the end, God used and oversaw the idiocy and manipulations of Laban, his ignorance, now his spite. And all these things are, of course, all being orchestrated for God's ultimate purposes and will. You know, I have come from a generational family of Missouri Synod Lutherans and generational clergy. There was no reason why that should have continued through me. I have three sons. There's no reason why it should continue. Only by the grace of God will it continue, right? When God gets a hold of someone, he never lets them go. When he determines the course and outcome of their life, it will never be changed. He is always the determining factor. He kills and he makes alive. He is the boss of everything. And so this is a tremendous and amazing reality that God has now converted the hearts of Rachel and Leah towards utter faithfulness to the point where they are no longer concerned about their future. This is tremendous, right? They are resolute that whatever the future holds will be completely fine because the God of Israel is with Israel. He's with Jacob. They are completely sure. They have seen, right? Jacob just spent however long it took in their conversation reiterating the fact that, well, whenever he told me that my inheritance would be striped, God made them all striped. And whenever he told me they were going to be spotted, he made it all spotted. And it made Laban mad that God was providing all these all these flocks for me. And he wasn't getting any flocks because every time Laban would say something, I got exactly what Laban said and he couldn't do anything about it, right? God directed all things for my favor, for our favor. And Rachel, like, you're right. Yeah. You know, your favor has increased, your holdings have increased, your flocks have increased, our fathers have decreased, he hates you, he hates us. What can we say? What can we really say? Disobey God? Like, let's not do exactly what God's telling you because everything in the evidence of our history shows that God is unfaithful, that he's not worthy of trust, that when he says something, he doesn't do it, that he's a liar. No, actually, everything that God has said, he has done. Everything that you've told us, God has directed, has been done. So now we trust you, go and do it. Right? We trust you.
Yeah, it's a marvelous response from Rachel and Leah. And it also stands out to me in this chapter, again, not that Jacob's family situation was perfect, but that, because we know it's not, but given the tension that was there, especially when we were hearing about all the children that Jacob was having, that Rachel and Leah at least at this moment seem to be on the same page, and they are together in this household. I don't think this is allegorical, but I think you do see a picture of when with the church that there's a bunch of sinners in the church that, despite their sins against each other, remain united in that one faith toward God. I think you see a bit of a picture of that here as the household of Jacob comes together for this to go back to the promised land.
Yes. That, I think what you're trying to summarize is love covers a multitude of sins.
Yeah.
Exactly what this is, right? Leah and Rachel, their love for Jacob has increased. Why has their love for Jacob increased? Because their love of God has increased. This is a direct correlation. The increase of faith and the increase of love are directly correlated, not caused, correlated. This is important for Christians to relate to. I like this. This isn't just important for Christians to relate to. This is important for married people to relate to, right? The success of Jacob is driven by God. He's shrewd. He is prudent. He is, you know, he navigates the earthly things well, you know, to succeed. But above all, he listens to God. If you are a young man looking for a wife, find a woman that listens to God. If you are a young woman looking for a husband, find a man that listens to God. Above it, he might be a garbage man. He might be a plumber. He might, whatever it might be. If he is a faithful, devoted, church-going, humble man or woman, like, what more could you really ask for? He could be a sheep herder in Wyoming, whatever. If he is faithful and his love for God is clear and evident, that is a good man. That is a good woman. And who knows what the future might hold? That is, of course, the underlying reality. Who knows what God might do with a sheep herder in Wyoming? And I'm not trying to focus, like, sheep herders Wyoming. Right? There's a lot of Lutherans that do sheep in Wyoming. Okay, fine. Right? The point is, when the love of God, when the faithfulness towards God and when love increase, generally good things come. But like earthly rewards come. It doesn't necessarily correlate that earthly rewards will come. But in the case of Jacob and Leah and Rachel, earthly rewards came. They had plenty of provisions for daily life. They had children, and they have an increasingly loving relation with each other. What more could you ask for as a man or a woman? To have an increasingly loving and increasingly homogenous home filled with children, and on top of all of that, you have your earthly needs cared for because you've made prudent financial decisions and God has blessed those things, right? That seems to work out across time. I experience this when I consider, an investment that I need to make, or I consider some decision that we're going to make, and I rush into it and I'm impulsive and I don't think about it and I don't consider, all of the things of the future. Generally, that falls apart. Generally, that turns out bad. Generally, I get penalized for that because of the way it is. When I'm prudent and thoughtful and I consider things and I pray and I deliberate and I ask about the benefit of it towards our household and I consult with my wife, like what Jacob is doing here with Leah and Rachel, like, listen, this is the way it's going. And they're like, yep, that's the way it is. Let's do this. Generally, things go a lot better. Generally, there is a... in the end now, I think a divine reward that comes in time for the practice of love and faithfulness, right? I don't think that is completely irresponsible to say. It seems to line up quite nicely with a lot of what Luther says about the two kinds of righteousness that exist. One, the activity of faith, right? And the other, the reality of righteousness and the daily rewards that go along here with earthly life. So...
yeah, we talked a lot about the response of Rachel and Leah toward the end of that section. The great majority of it is Jacob's speech to them in saying where they're going to go, what he's proposing. As you've noted a couple of times, I think on the one hand, this is a very ordinary scene in that you have a husband who is speaking to his wife about the course of action that he's proposing so that they can be on the same page. But I think as we look at it within the context, this isn't Jacob trying to be manipulative of Rachel and Leah or trying to convince them of something that is bad for them. I do think within the speech of Jacob, you see his own faith come through, where perhaps in other moments in his story it hasn't been as clear. He recognizes in this speech that what has happened to him has not been, again, as you've been pointing out all along, not by chance or good luck, but this has been the Lord who has been working these things in very miraculous ways that I think, Jacob, with the thing with the branches in the previous text, we talked about it yesterday, that like, where did this come from? Well, Jacob at least recognizes very clearly here, it wasn't his own cunning. Yep. This was the Lord directing things for his favor. Other features from Jacob's speech that stand out to you?
Well, this development of faith or growth of faith, it is the exact copy of what happened with Abraham. You brought this up already, how early in Abram's journey with Sarai to Egypt, Abram was ready to, Abram delivered Sarai over to the Pharaoh, and it was the Pharaoh that got mad about the immorality, right? This pagan Pharaoh was like, what are you doing? I can't sleep with your wife. This is terrible. And Abram's like, oh, sorry. I was just trying to save my life. It's unbelievable the immorality and stupidity that Abram and Sarah showed. You already talked about Sarah shoving Hagar into old Abram's tent. Like, we got to get this going. My eggs aren't, what they used to be. Like, let's get this whole baby thing going. Right? Like, God laughs. He just flat out laughs when human creatures in our ignorance and immaturity and in our unfaithfulness in believing that God is lying to us, that he is holding out on us, that he is somehow, that he is somehow riding our back with the stick and the carrot and he keeps yanking it out as soon as we want to get a bite, right? Like when Jacob matures, when he goes through what he has to go through, from his days living with Isaac and his own mother and the old episodes with Esau up into the present day with dealing with Laban, what he is now learning, and he will learn this even more, right? He will learn this when he wrestles by the ford of the Jabbok. He will learn this when he has to reconcile with Esau, when he sees in the reconciliation with Esau the bright face of God in that reconciliation. We have to learn these things too. We have to learn and be humbled into the belief and the trust that God is truly a good gift giver for us, that he is not simply and only a good gift giver to us in spiritual things, which he most certainly is. And above all, that is the most important thing, which is what Jacob is learning, but also in temporal things. He wants what's good for his people in temporal matters. He doesn't like to see his people suffer, but he knows, and this is true, that in any circumstance, we can learn what it means to be content, just like St. Paul did. In any tribulation, it does not come because the circumstances around us are always comfortable or there is plenty or whatever. It comes because of ultimately the revelation of God's good grace and favor through a word. That is what it does. So when God says, I will be with you, what Jacob is now revealing is that I trust this beyond everything else. I do not know what the future holds precisely. I know that I'm going to go home, but I don't know exactly what all is going to happen, but God has promised he is going to be with me. And that's all that is what I will put everything on. And so it is the same here for these ladies, right? They, you know, initially don't understand the connection between God, the God of Israel, the God of Jacob, and Jacob. They don't understand it in relation to them. Now they see it, right? He goes through and recounts everything that God has done for them. And the ladies are like, yeah, you're right. You're like, God has taken away from, he is killing our father's home. He is taking everything away. He is increasing his bitterness. And you're receiving flocks and rewards and joy and children and loving wives. Sounds great. Sounds wonderful.
Right. So the family is going to go together back to the land where the Lord is leading them and has commanded to Jacob to go. They're all on the same page. And so the journey begins in verse 17. So Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock, all his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." And that's where we are pausing today. We'll finish the story of what happens in the next episode. So Pastor Belts, we got about 11 or so minutes here to talk about these verses. There's a number of things that we could mention. Maybe since we've talked about the faithfulness of Rachel and Leah both, there's this detail that becomes important in the story again tomorrow that it says Rachel stole her father's household gods.
Yep.
What's going on there in verse 19?
All right, these teraphim, right? The Hebrew teraphim, it's like really these. This is still a very dominant Eastern and African theme, okay? So when I was over in Asia, one of the things that was really jarring to me as a Westerner, right, somebody that sort of came from a Christian or pseudo-Christian saturated culture and life, just living in America, when I went over to Asia and saw all of the little monuments and temples that existed in the homes of the people, like in Vietnam and in Taiwan and in Thailand and Cambodia, like every home and in their fields, right? These little tombs and memorials and temples are all over the place. And you would ask, what is this? And these were these connections, you know, in the East, the ancestors that had died were now, you know, sort of connected to the land or connected to the home through these portals and these images, and offerings would be made to satisfy these passed along relatives that were now these quasi deities in this other world that still could manipulate the fortunes of people in present day. And Rachel steals these things. She is truly Jacob's wife. This is amazing. Right. She is going to she steals these things out of the home. Now, this is a tremendous sign of judgment against Laban, that the daughter takes these religious totems out of the home. This is a this is a scandal to Laban. So one of the things, one of the most astounding and terrifying moments that I had when I was a missionary over in Asia was that. So sadly, when I was in Taiwan,
or not sadly, but beneficially, there's a lot of females that convert to Christianity before males. And it's because for males, the maintenance of this sort of household God religion is drummed into them from birth, that they are the ones that carry that through the male lineage of the household. They have to continue this worship of ancestors. Well, there was this one time that this girl had this major conversion experience, and she brought to the school that I worked in, she brought this little, you know, abode, this little temple portal that her father had put in her room. Like, we would put a crucifix or some image of Christianity in the rooms of our children over their bed. This little temple existed in this girl's room, and she brought this thing to school and burned it. And you thought that we white American Christians had started some new war against the Taiwanese religion when the father found out about this because of this daughter's conversion. It was a disaster. He was mad, had his sons there, right? Like, it was up at the school and we were getting chewed out by this Taiwanese guy and Taiwanese. It was crazy, right? He was hot. But this is exactly what happened, right? This is what happened. This little girl, this 12-year-old girl that was this junior high student that had this very sincere conversion to Christianity, she knew that this temple was wrong and she didn't want it in her room anymore. And she didn't just like give it back to her father. She brought it to the school and she burned it. Like, it was a definitive, you know, conversion experience. She didn't want anything to do with this anymore. And I think that's a part of what's going on here with Rachel stealing these household gods. These gods are impotent. They do not dictate the course of anything. And this is a big slap in the face to Laban. Like, the two girls have already determined that their father wants nothing to do with them. Their alignment with Jacob has now destroyed their relation to their father. And they have become completely captured by the story that God is unfolding for them in relation to Jacob, and especially moving forward. And what they're doing to Laban here is slapping him across the face. Like, it's either a wake-up call, it's some sort of rebuke, whatever you want to call it. She steals these household gods, which reveals their powerlessness. Their powerlessness over everything that's happening. They can't even stop the girl, the little girl, probably not a little girl anymore, but they can't stop this little from stealing them. They have no power. And this only gets reiterated at the end of this whole thing, where God shows up to Laban and is like, don't do it. Don't even say anything. Don't say it. Right. Like, you got away with a lot for these last several years. Don't even say anything bad about Jacob. All right. Which is an amazing bookend here at the conclusion of this thing, where Laban's all hot. He's mad. He gets tricked. Right. His daughters steal his household gods. He doesn't have any more sheep spotted or striped goats or whatever. Right. They're all going out to Padam Aram. They're all headed back out to Canaan to be with Isaac. Jacob's gone. His children are gone. The daughters are gone. The household gods are gone. All the flocks are gone. He doesn't have hardly anything left. And then God shows up and goes, Nope, don't get to complain. This is the way it works. You had a lot of benefit here for a long period of time. Jacob brought you a lot of success, and now it's over, buddy. Which is just a tremendous, like, conclusion here. I love God's, I mean, he truly does have this dark sense of humor, I guess, if you want to say it in that way, right? God, like, listen, it is a very similar connection later on, where Joseph ushers in, like, to this man Jacob and all of his ancestors, what will be all of his ancestors, the security of Egypt, under the promise that, hey, you know, Joseph says to Pharaoh, these people are farmers, they raise sheep, we're going to stick them out here in this area, they're going to raise crops, they're going to raise sheep, and they're going to be a benefit to Egypt in the time of famine, they're going to secure the economy and the well-being of the nation, we're going to bring them in. Right. And then at the end, when God says, after 432 years, well, that's enough. Right. It's not just that God takes them out of Egypt. He utterly decimates the religion of Egypt and the security that any Egyptian might have in the gods of Egypt. So that at the Exodus event, what we learn, and I can't remember the exact verse here, but that a host of people, a mixed multitude, actually comes out of Egypt, not just Israel. Because it's not just clear to Israel that God is in charge of everything and destroying Egypt. It's clear to everybody. It's clear to all, like, there's tons of Egyptians that are like, we don't want to mess with this. This is crazy. These gods don't do anything. Our gods are worthless. We got to stick to this God of Egypt or this God of Israel. He's the true God. And so that's a really similar episode to what you have here. This mini Exodus coming out of Laban's household, this revelation that Laban's religion, that these idols, these household gods that he has are impotent, that all of the malicious works that Laban has tried to foist now upon Jacob and his children and his daughters it's impotent too. God's hand is with Jacob. And just like it's a little less dramatic than the closing up of the Red Sea over hard-hearted Pharaoh and all of his hosts. But here at the end, God is standing with his hands up and to Laban goes, don't even talk. Don't even say it. Don't say nothing. This is over.
Yeah.
You lost. Jacob's gone. And you don't. That's it. Right. So I love it. I love the way that this all comes together. I love the connections that you can make to other stories. I love the humor here from God. At least I interpret this as, I find this very humorous, the way that God sort of ends this episode. Don't say anything good. Don't say anything bad. Don't say nothing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think just a couple of thoughts to what you said about the household gods. One of the things that the text just doesn't give to us is any motivation on Rachel's part as to why she does this. You know, is there some doubt there? I mean, of course, we're all sinners. Is she looking to make money somehow? You know, we don't get the motivation.
Yeah.
So I think the point that you made, though, that the text is making fun of these false gods is something, and showing their impotence. I mean, the uselessness of Laban trusting in them is absolutely there in the text. We'll see it again tomorrow when they show up again in the text.
Yep. I think it has to do with the sincerity of their conversion, too.
Yes. Yeah. And then the other thing.
If they believe they had any power, there's no way they touch these things. If there was any sort of strange spiritual force or power that they credited to these images, there's no way they touch them. They go in there and they wipe them off the shelf, stuff them in a bag, and throw them over their shoulder, right? Showing just what sort of, you know, trash they actually are. So
sure. And then the other thing, the similarities to other stories, the idea of the people of God, well, the people of Israel fleeing away from someone who has made them slaves, and that person chasing after them and catching up with them and the Lord rescuing them. Like, it's not the exact same story as the Exodus, but it's looking forward to that. Even with the defeat of the false gods of Egypt, you have the defeat of the false gods of Laban here. Like, all of these things are setting the stage for God's deliverance. And I think maybe that's the way to wrap this up today, is that we are seeing here the Lord delivering Jacob according to the Lord's promise. He's being faithful and bringing Jacob to the place that he has promised to give him, along with all the blessings that he's been given along the way. So it's fitting into that larger story that ultimately points us toward the deliverance that is ours in Christ Jesus. Pastor Sam Belts serves at St. John Lutheran Church in Oskaloosa, Iowa. He's been helping us today to study Genesis chapter 31, verses 1 to 24. Pastor Belts, thanks for being our guest today.
So nice to be here again, Tim. Looking forward to the next time already.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about this text, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we keep reading in Genesis chapter 31 to see what happens in the interaction between Laban and Jacob. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.